Shalom LaYehudim, Shalom LaBnei Noach, Shalom LaGoyim. It's the evening of the sixth day, Yud Gimel B'Chodesh Teves, Parashas Vayechi, Tavshinayin Vav, the evening of the fifth day, to Thursday, 24 December 2015, webcasting from the Bleeding Holy Land. Well, yesterday you all know of the two Jewish men, one age 40, one 47, both husbands, both fathers to children, whose lives were ended along the exterior wall of the old city just west of the Jaffa Gate, when suddenly two wild rabbit asses in human form fell upon them with knives, plunging their knives into them. In the end, all four died. And not for the first time, CNN and the New York Times exposed the anti-Jewitis that cripples their hearts, minds, and souls in covering this latest human sacrifice of a member of that unique nation that uniquely almost 4,000 years ago came out opposed to human sacrifice. One of the facets of the story of Abraham binding his son for a human sacrifice was not going through with it. Times ran the headline, "Two Palestinians killed, boo-hoo. Two Israelis die in Jerusalem," close quote. Yeah, die, that's an intransitive verb. And, of course, the cause or causes of their deaths were not mentioned. We learn that the Palestinians were killed, but how the two Jews expired is not mentioned. After protests from the government of Israel, the Times, 8 hours later, ran a revised headline saying, "Palestinian stabbers kill Israeli. Assailant shot dead." In a way, these news companies are complicit in this generation's fashion of Jew killing. In every generation, there's a fashion, the technique changes. In the 16th century in Spain, in many towns and villages, every Sunday, Catholics would gather, not to go to a football game as they do today, but to the plaza in front of the local parish church to watch a Jew tied to a stake to be burnt to death. In 20th century Europe, the technique included gassing with poison gas and burning their bodies. Today, it's these sudden eruptions of demoniacal homicidal violence by these animalistic barbarians, these Muslim Arabs with their knife attacks. I believe that these savages are calling this latest fashion the knife intifada. And in the reportage, the MSM is exposing once again its dhimmitude. That's what these headlines are all about. I'm reading an excellent book by a friend and colleague, Michael Widlansky, which is available on Amazon, in which this journalist, who's fluent in Arabic, and like yours truly, a sometime government contract worker, reports on being hired to inspect the treasure trove of Fatah documents the IDF confiscated in the Mukata. That was Arafat's lair. That proved conclusively that the second intifada that erupted in 2000 was hardly spontaneous, and that every turn it was under Arafat's control. In other words, Arafat was, at that point, trashing the Oslo Accords. Mr. Widlansky offered an exclusive article to the New York Times regarding these documents, which were explosive to the Oslo peace process, as the Pentagon Papers in the 1970s were to the war in Vietnam. Only this time, when the Times had gone to court, the Supreme Court, to fight for the right to publish those Pentagon Papers, this time they turned him away. They didn't want the story. It didn't fit the Times' editorial opinion. In this, the Times was complicit in all the Jewish blood spilled in that intifada. His book, by the way, is called Battle for Our Minds. A very good book. In other words, this grotesque perversion of morality in the way both CNN and the Times covered the Jew killing yesterday is the real story. Pouncing on Jews with knives is becoming, you know, kind of routine. More important is the anti-Semitic bent of both these news media outlets, which is to ask the question, what do we do about it? What do we do about this double-barreled problem of these knifings on the one hand and the car rammings? There are three incidents today, I think. Two more barbarians were put to death. No civilized Jew was wounded, thank God. What to do about the media as well? Regarding their reportage of this latest fashion in Jew-killing operations. As for the media, the Times and CNN, they should be denied all governmental recognition here and assistance, at least for a period of time. The government should make hay out of this. And as for the suicidal, homicidal Muslim predators. PMW's Palestine Media Watch's Itamar Marcus. He is an even-tempered, non-extremist fellow director of PMW. He made the case that Abbas is where the buck stops. And I say, it's simply self-abasement that Israel does not parry his aggression when it's blatant now. He must be told to either condemn the attacks or pay the price in terms of perhaps what he enjoys most. Just like Arafat, he loves to fly around the world to meet with heads of state and complain about the demonic Jews. So Israel should deny him that freedom. Yesterday, Abbas also sent out a Christmas message which included smearing the Jews for, quote, consolidating an apartheid regime by accelerating policies that destroy the two-state solution, close quote. Here, too, Israel has to publicly demand that this character retract his accusation of apartheid, because there is no apartheid in Israel. Apartheid in South Africa was about skin color. And there's not one law, statute, ordinance in Israel concerning skin color. Abbas must confess his lie that Israel is an apartheid regime. And if he does not, Israel can profit from that too, by recognizing that it has the right to profit, first of all. After all, I mean, I long for the day when an Israeli government stands erect and looks world anti-Jewry in the eye and declares there's nothing Palestinian about these charlatans who call themselves Palestinians, and they have no right whatsoever to a state in the heart of the heart of the land of Israel promised to the Jewish people in their Bible by God Almighty 180 times. I know that because one year I counted all 180 times myself. Abbas, in his Christmas message, said there can be no Palestinian state without Jerusalem as its capital, and Israel has to answer when hell freezes over. And if that is his demand, there can be no point to negotiating with him. Indeed, it is high time Prime Minister Binyamin Ben-Gvir follow through with what was expected of him in 1996. It's almost 20 years now. He was elected that year to put an end to the three-year-old madness of Oslo. But he didn't do that. He didn't have the courage. I also think that as a Sabra, a secular Sabra, he lacked a proper assessment of the demands of the international community when he became prime minister that he was required to carry through with Oslo. I think he thought they really cared about the mythical Palestinians. And all these Goy enemies have ever wanted is to prey upon Jews. The mythical Palestinians are just an excuse. Now, though, maybe the prime minister, after Obama is gone, will do that. He may finally have the kishkes to declare the Oslo peace process a failure, dead and impossible to bring back to life, because that's what has to be done. We've been living since September 1993 with the Oslo assumptions and prescriptions, and they have proven themselves to be failures. Someone, and if not the Prime Minister of Israel, someone has to shout out that the emperor of the Oslo peace process has no clothes. Oslo was misconceived from day one by Balin, Peres, Rabin, three of the most foolish Jews in Jewish history. All three had come to adulthood in the cocoon of narcissism that was labor Zionist thinking. None of them experienced the real world. In the real world, serious people don't make deals with the likes of Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas, for they are proven to be, besides being psychopathic mass murderers, untrustworthy. Oslo must be declared a dead horse, a complete failure, and the relationship between the state of Israel and the Arabs living in Judea and Samaria reconfigured without this proven fantasy of the two-state solution, which implies an expulsion of Jews, an impoverishment of Jews that would dwarf the expulsion from Spain and be more in a class with the Holocaust and the hundreds of thousands of Jews who had to flee for their lives and leave behind all their worldly wealth to the persecuting Goyim. The two-state solution is what Obama and Kerry and Matt Dick and that whole cult speak of with a smile on their faces, as if the two-state solution is the Emerald City of peace that they dream of, and they are silent on the implication of their dream that all these 500,000 Jews in Judea and Samaria will be turned into refugees, like Jewish refugees down the corridors of time. The Oslo peace process has masked this ancient drive by Jew-hating Goyim to drive Jews from their homes and property. They hunger to do it in every generation. And in our time, the justification for the dream is that the Jews twice in 1948, 1967 stole Palestine from the ancient Palestinians and won't give back any of it to their victims who have been pining for a state since the sixth day of creation. This is the two-state solution's justification, and as always, in the history of Jewish suffering, our suffering is to be fit punishment for our crimes. Well, the other top story here today, besides the daily attempts to murder us, was the ongoing detention of one or more young Jews by the GSS and the protest by some members of the National Religious Camp that the boy and or boys have been tortured. The demand that no evidence has surfaced to connect them to the firebombing last July of an Arab family in the Arab settlement of Douma. And the boys are being treated, they said, like Arab detainees in an effort to get them to confess and or reveal information when their backers say they have none, they're innocent. The new twist in the story today was the apparently successful effort by Defense Minister Yalon to convince leaders in Yosh, Yudava, and Shvishamon that indeed the culprits were Jews who belonged to a clique, if not cult, bent on destroying the Israeli government. Now those who have spoken up for the detainees are persuaded the GSS is onto something. There have been demonstrations by hundreds of settlement youth, clashes with the police, demands that those detained be freed. The national religious leader Naftali Bennett sides with the defense minister and trusts that the GSS head, Yossi Cohen, is in charge and faithfully operating within legal limits in his handling of the suspects. There has been no torture, he says. The prime minister says, Bennett says, Army Reserve Officer Moti Yogev of the same command camp, also of Habayat Yudi, says no torture. And most important now, they all are of the opinion that indeed, A, Jews did do the terrible deed, and B, these Jews are dangerous. And then today, a video surfaced purporting to show a wedding celebration recently attended by soulmates of the detainees celebrating the Douma horror. Well, I can testify as a first-hand witness to the existence of such types. I think it was the last Sukkot. I was a guest in a sukkah with a family, with teenage boys, all ardently religious, Chabdal, we can call them, and whose parents have thought well of the late Meir Kahane and imbued that feeling with their sons. And at one point, the boys, one of them told me, a teenager, that he had a text inside in the house in which there is a sentence justifying the random killing of Arabs. And I told him sharply, "You will not sermonize morality to me, and if you think that sentence licenses you to kill any Arab at random, you are seriously mistaken." In other words, there's no doubt in my mind of the presence in this country of teenage sociopaths, like the two who last year set fire to a school in Jerusalem for Jews and Arabs, established by trendy post-Jewish Israeli liberals. Much damage was done to the building, but thank God no harm to people. But by the recklessness of the act, this act of vandalism with fire was a sign for me of a seriously disordered mindset. You know, I think there were two brothers. Indeed, I have been an anti-Kahanite since before most people ever heard of him. Meir Kahane was an unknown 36-year-old rabbi in Brooklyn in 1968 when he founded his JDL, his Jewish Defense League, to protect Jews from violent, mostly Negro aggressors in that feverish year. In April of 1968, Columbia University, where yours truly was a student, erupted in massed protests against the war in Vietnam and the allegedly high-handed university abuse of neighboring Harlem. The occupation of buildings and vandalism was front-page news in the United States and the MSM. On the cover of Time, Life, and Newsweek, everybody and his brother in politics made it his business to visit the campus and express himself in the MSM on the upheaval. The campus was a circus for weeks on end of demonstrations and celebrities and whatnot. And one day on 114th Street, there was a camera crew interviewing a man surrounded by several boys, obviously his devotees, and they were a curious crew. This was the first time Meir Kahane made it onto the television. The boys looked small, unathletic, too small for the big black leathered motorcycle jackets they were wearing and the posturing of being rough and tough and spoiling for a fight. They had a sign saying JDL, and yours truly, by sheer coincidence, happened to be standing there. And I listened to the man's rap and found it peculiar, to say the least. He seemed to think he was in Germany in 1936 and under attack by Nazis, and he and his JDL were going to fight back. It was so out of place in the 1960s when that very year before, Time magazine had run a cover story on how great it was to be a Jew in America and how the old anti-Semitism had evaporated and how many Gentiles like to brag of their Jewish friends. In a nutshell, in the spring of 1968 at Columbia, where maybe as many 40% of the undergrads were Jews, there was no threat of Nazis. This man and his little boys were reacting to a menace that wasn't there. And then the same Robert Kahana was connected to the bombing of the office in Midtown of Saul Hurek, the famous impresario who represented the Bolshoi Ballet in Leningrad and other Russian dance enterprises, bringing them over to perform in the States as part of a thaw in the Cold War, the age of detente, when Rabbi Kahana, to his great credit, had also made the imprisonment of Jews in the Soviet Union, millions of them, his cause. Credit is due. But he didn't like Saul Hurek for working with the authorities there. And so a bomb was placed in the man's office. And a secretary, a middle-aged Jewish woman, was killed. Kahana then made Aliyah and made a spectacle of himself in Israel, harassing Arabs for no reason. Eventually, he was expelled from the Knesset, I think twice. Not for his ideas, which were not all that original in any case, not unique, really, but mainstream leftist ideas in the 1930s. It was his personality. He was abrasive, and his acolytes unappealing in their hostility, not only to Arabs, but fellow Jews. When Kahana made Aliyah, he was followed by a devotee from Brooklyn, Baruch Goldstein, whom Kahana married in front of he and his wife, in front of Damascus Gate in the Arab section of Jerusalem, so that this was no conventional Jewish wedding, but one in which the bride and groom and rabbi were simultaneously giving their finger to the Arabs. And then Goldstein massacred all those Muslims. That's why the GSS and the Prime Minister, and now sober leaders of the Jews in Judea and Samaria, are backing the GSS. There is a repeating, undeniable connection between this cult and violence that Israel can do without. My feeling in 1966 was that the boys I was looking at in this obscure little demonstration had personal problems about violence, and they used the eternal war against the Jews as an excuse to justify their desire for some kind of instantaneous cataclysmic solution to the Arab aggression against us. Transfer now! They fantasized an overnight expulsion of over 2 million Arabs, after which peace will reign and we will suffer from them no more. The logistics of driving 2 million Arabs out of the country overnight are not something they spend time thinking about. How many buses would it take and how much gasoline had to be purchased for these buses carrying 2 million Arabs down to the Jordan River and kicking them out of the country, and of course, Jordan would do nothing to stop the invasion. In a nutshell, it's a dream. The dream of expelling all the Arabs at once. Life is more complicated than they imagine. So I, too, this last week, have not commented on this situation because I, too, side with what now seems to be a growing consensus that the GSS is onto something. And these boys and their friends do, in fact, pose a menace. I find it hard to believe that the GSS and all involved are so corrupt they're persecuting innocent boys for no reason other than to discredit their philosophy. I don't think they're that evil. Those two boys who set fire to that school, whose philosophy of mixed Arab-Jewish schooling I, too, reject, are likely not the only two out there out of control. Youngsters of the so-called extreme right wing, who can be dangerous. Since 1968, I've thought they suffer from an unhealthy obsession with violence, with thoughts and fantasies that some of them act out. Baruch Goldstein was Rabbi Kahana's right-hand man, and it's no coincidence that Dr. Goldstein ended this life as he did, doing something an Arab would do. This is why the GSS is doing what it's doing. I don't believe their cruelty is done in the knowledge these boys are innocent and they just want to discredit their thinking and their movement with a false accusation. If that's true, then they are indeed monsters. But I don't believe it, and I do feel fear when I think of such boys.
בואו נפזר את מסך הערפל, בואו נעמוד באור ולא בצל. עד מתי נמשיך לברוח אל משחקים של כוח? מותר לך לבכות קצת לפעמים, משהו קורא לך בפנים. ספר לי קצת על רגעי הפחד, קל הרבה יותר לפחד ביחד. וכשרוחות קרות תיסערו בחוץ, תזעק אליו בתפילה. יום אחד אולי תפסיק לרוץ בין הצללים. וכשרוחות קרות תיסערו בחוץ, תזעק אליו בתפילה. יום אחד אולי תפסיק לרוץ בין הצללים בנשמה. עד מתי נמשיך לברוח אל משחקים של כוח? מותר לך לבכות קצת לפעמים, כשמשהו קורה לך בפנים. ספר לי קצת על רגעי הפחד, קל הרבה יותר לפחד ביחד. כשרוחות קרות תיסערו בחוץ, תזעק אליו בתפילה. יום אחד אולי תפסיק לרוץ בין הצללים בנשמה.
You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. I imagine you all saw that news item out of San Diego, University of California, San Diego, where an Iranian woman professor of religion, wanting to combat what she hallucinates is a plague of Islamophobia, began a class by distributing the Yellow Star of David patch Jews had to wear in Nazi Germany to her students, only instead of Yuda inscribed in the middle, it was Muslim. When the Jews protested this false analogy to the world of Nazi Germany associated with what she sees as frightening evidence of Islamophobia, the university spoke up in her defense, calling it, quote, a learning tool that was, quote, adapted as a respected symbol of all three Abrahamic faiths of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, to represent solidarity, and was not intended to make an analogy between discrimination against Muslims and the persecution of Jews in Germany and throughout Europe during the Holocaust, close quote. Yeah, sure. And Fort Hood was workplace violence, and if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. The American experiment in democratic self-rule is, I fear, spinning out of control when leaders of its highest educational institutions, like the once-respected UC system in California, talk like this. The country of America is in serious trouble. As Obama leads a Muslim life of constant denial, taking no responsibility for anything, here was this university administrator denying that any analogy was intended by this stunt. Good Lord, that is all that it was. An analogy. And it was deranged for... Factually, first of all, there is no tsunami of Islamophobia in America, All the facts show that the number of anti-Jew episodes is like 6 times greater than that of reported anti-Islam incidents. And never mind the brainlessness, unexamined cliche that Islam, like Christianity, is an Abrahamic religion. In Abraham's religion, the father is prevented from sacrificing his own son. In Christianity, the father presides over the torture to death of his son. And as for Islam being Abrahamic, please, Abraham was the kindest man in the world in his generation. And as we see almost daily the jaw-dropping cruelty of these Muslims, their brains on fire with the satanic forms of death and torture, mutilation, and horror head chopping, there's absolutely nothing Abrahamic about Muslims who are, in opposition to Abraham, world famous for their cruelty. I think this is just the same old, that foolish Iranian professor and her superiors at UC San Diego. It's just more stealing from the Jews. The way the Roman Catholic Church calls itself in Latin, Veris Yisrael, the true Israel. In a Catholic's universe, Catholics are the real Jews, you see. Stealing from the Jews. Islam, too, is another form of intellectual property theft. Islam means submission and refers to Abraham submitting to God's command that he bind his son Isaac for a sacrifice and on the spot of the future temple in Jerusalem. But Muslims insist that the Jews are liars who perverted the truth. Islam insists that the son bound was Ismail, not Ishak, and it happened in Mecca. Islam is a plagiarized, stolen form of Judaism. Everybody wants a piece of Jewish intellectual wealth, heritage, and property, like the anti-Israelite U.S. UN ambassadress Samantha Power, who wrote a book about genocides in the plural and thereby reduced the uniqueness of the world's one real genocide, the Holocaust. Genocide was invented by Raphael Lemkin, a survivor, a linguist, because there was not any word in any of the languages he knew to describe what had just happened. Genocide he invented because it is not a synonym for massacre. What the Turks did to the Armenians in 1915 was not genocide, but the kind of barbaric massacre known throughout history. The Turks were not out to hunt down every Armenian on the planet and kill him and her. They just wanted the land the Armenians lived on and had no civilized scruples about how they took it. But that's still not genocide. The Holocaust was unique. The Arabs, eternally envious of the Jews, envy even the Holocaust because it gives us moral authority and clout. So they invented a parallel Nakba, in which story they become the Jews and the Jews become the Nazis. This Yellow Star demo is just more stealing from the Jews.
ואמרתם כל אחי אדוננו מקור חוכמה הוא ראש בני ישראל הוא איש חי נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה להתחזק בשמחה כל הזמן להתקרב לרבינו רבי נחמן גם כשנפלת אתה קם בזכות הצדיק יסוד עולם נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה אדוננו מקור חוכמה ישראל הוא איש חי נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה נחל נובע מקור חוכמה.
Okay, that's it for this week, and God willing, we'll be back after the Holy Sabbath. Until then, Laila Tov, Shabbat Shalom, Eretz Yisrael.